at the exact time when that's the last thing that we need.
Yeah, and Bill, we are going to be discussing that more on Sojourner Truth, because it is very worrying. The timid, how the media, absolutely mainstream media, are rolling over. And I'm very, very worried, Bill, about the divisions that are being promoted between Black and Brown communities. That is something that I think is also a
Absolutely.
danger that we have to
Yes.
watch. But sadly, we're out of time. Like I gotta go, unfortunately. But we'll have you all back, because there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot that we must know. There's a lot that we must do. I appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Margaret.
And today's show, pre-recorded, it'll be heard at its regular time out of KPFK on Tuesday, and on several other Pacifica stations and affiliates throughout the day. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. And you can listen to the show, as I said, going online and looking for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air next Tuesday. We want to thank you for listening, and please stay well and safe. And those of you in Southern California, remember to mask up. As Bill Gallego said, there's a lot of really, really bad stuff still in the air. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO FM every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon. Co-hosts O.B. Hill, Patricia Welch, and Emma Jackson Ford discuss African-American authors and books. That's Black Book Talk, every first Thursday from 11:30 till noon on KBOO-FM.
Check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, news, views, and hip-hop.
And I am Elizabeth Patricia Martinez here with Hard Knock Radio. And you are?
I'm Yuri Kochiyama with Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
You know you're dealing with the Black Terror, bless Darth Vader. Only bite my tongue when I rock the crossfader. This is the grand verbalizer, funk a lesson, Brother J and the X-Clan. Big up and respect to Hard Knock Radio.
Everybody knows that all the people don't have liberties, all the people don't have freedom, all the people don't have justice, and all the people don't have power, so that means none of us do. Take this country and change it. Turn it upside down and put the last verse and the first last. Not only for Black people, but for all people.
Gather round, it's time to rise. Voices loud, we seek a prize. Mover shakers, hear them speak. Wisdom strong, it's time to seek. We won't bow, we won't fall. Together we stand, united we call. I love you wonderful. Hard Knock, rocking on your radio. We speak the truth, let the wisdom flow. Hard Knock, rocking on your radio, fighting for the people. Power to the people, we unite.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We've been doing a little bit of a roundup over the past few days, getting people's perspective from a variety of walks of life about the incoming president. Donald Trump, as you know, is the 47th president. He's been reinstalled. What does that mean? We want to look at some of the policies, the fallout, some of the things that are being touted about, and of course, what is going to be happening with some of the key issues that we have long been talking about on this show. One of the issues that we have been looking at going back way before actually October 7th, but looking at the occupation of the Palestinian territories, what is happening with Palestinian peoples, what is happening with the discussions and debates and what have you around those issues, and in particular, what has been happening since October 7th. I wanted to have Amaya Gelman, who's the director of the Institute of Critical Study of Zionism, teaches writing about policing, race, queers, neocons, empire, and anti-Zionists. Welcome to the show. And thanks. You cover a lot of ground. all these are frontline issues that have been put in the forefront with Donald Trump and his campaign. And he has a lot of people that want to carry out attacks on folks who are queer, folks who are non-Anglo-Saxon. They've been talking about raising the empire. They've been staunchly in the corner of Zionists. And anybody who doesn't look or sound like them is in the crosshairs. So how have you been seeing things with this installation? I know you saw it coming down the pipe a long time ago, so you're not shocked. But now that this is happening, how are you seeing things right now?
Well, like you say, I cover a lot of ground with looking at Zionism and looking at racism and police repression, neoconservatism, and they're all tied together, right? It's not like covering a lot of different topics. They're all tied up. And so with the appearance of Trump is kind of just sort of the culmination of a lot of things that have been happening for a long time. One of them, which we saw, was it yesterday or the day before, was when this idea that like there are essentially Nazis who are part of the Trump administration. You know, Musk is doing his Nazi salute, and he's certainly not the only avowed racist and nationalist in the Trump administration. And then we have, a sort of weird response from the institutions that say that they support civil rights, but are actually also part of the Israel support and Zionism support structure that got Trump elected. We're seeing the culmination of a lot of things that have been cooking up for a long time, and we can talk about any aspect of them. It'll all come back together when we
right.
get to
that. Well, you mentioned Elon Musk, and this has been the topic du jour, so let's start with that and dig deeper. The man gave a speech, and then at the end, he gave a salute. It's a salute that I saw right here in Berkeley, when they had these marches with avowed neo-Nazis who were talking about Hail Hitler. I saw this mm-hmm. right downtown Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I've seen it when people were chanting in Charlottesville, right? Jews will not replace us. I remember that clearly. And we had people on yesterday that were in Charlottesville and dealt with that. I've also seen the Anti-Defamation League and other organizations pull out all the stops, go full throttle on people. We'll just talk about the last year, who said, I think we should have a ceasefire. Jamal Bowman, Congressman, Cori Bush, guest on our show, Congresswoman, folks that are in college and in, you know, high school campuses, we should have a ceasefire. They come under relentless attack. They've seen their names dragged through the mud. They've been accused of being anti-Semitic for simply calling for peace in the Middle East. We're mm-hmm. not talking about making gestures. But to see the ADL put out a statement and tell us what we just saw
was not anti-Semitic and it wasn't a Nazi salute. When we've seen people get dragged and upended for doing things far, far less than what Elon Musk did, was the ultimate gaslighting. And so this leaves an array of questions. Of course, the obvious one is, what did we see? Why did the ADL put that response? And this gets into the deeper conversation. When you see folks who say that they're against anti-Semitism hanging out with folks who are anti-Semitic is baffling to me. Way before Elon Musk hit the field, we had Steve Bannon, who constantly talked about wanting us to control and get rid of globalists. And globalists, as I've been taught, is a code word in another way of suggesting that Jewish folks dominate, you know, banking systems and all this, and our problems are really situated in what globalists, aka Jewish people, control. So to see that he's back on the scene, along with Elon Musk giving a Nazi salute and the ADL excusing it, Michael Rappaport online saying, you know, excusing it, make it make sense. And then let's go to the deeper pictures behind this.
It's chaotic. Let's start with the question, what did we see? Right? Like, let's just start with the evidence in front of us. So yeah, I think we saw the same thing. I'm with you. I saw him pound his chest, and then I don't care if he was thinking in his mind that he was doing a Nazi salute or if he was just doing it, right? Like, he knows what's going on in the world. He knows the context that he's in. So I'm going to say that was a Nazi salute. And I will also say that, you know, people laughed so hard when the ADL came out and said, like, it wasn't a Nazi salute. Like, we all expected Musk to come out and be like, no, it was. Right. So we all saw that. We saw it in a context where, you know, like, where we know that white supremacists are looking for permission and kind of like the, you know, the sign to launch, right? So it's serious stuff. And then we saw the other thing that we saw was the Anti-Defamation League come out like a completely different animal from what it's been, you know, and when it's dealing with Palestine Solidarity Movement folks and saying like, well, let's have a little bit of grace. Like, maybe he didn't mean it. Whereas those of us, you know, those of us who are protesting genocide, including lots of Jews who are protesting genocide, the ADL says like, we're, you know, Jews who are protesting genocide are marginal. Well, we're terrorists, we're Hamas supporters, right? Like, so there's no grace there. The question is why? What's like, what is the ADL doing? This is a long conversation, but the ADL, you know, it depends on where you want to start. But like, I'm a historian. I look at the ADL. I'm actually just finishing up a book on the ADL right now. So I'm deep in that history. The ADL started in 1913 as a white settler organization. It said it was dealing with anti-Semitism. It surely was concerned that people were saying, you know, bad things about Jews. But actually what was going on was that there were lots of Jewish immigrants who were, you know, Jewish immigrants coming around the turn of the century who were poor and leftists, communists, socialists, anarchists, and were not Central European. They were Eastern European. And the people who created the ADL, also the American Jewish Committee, were like, just, they were rich white guys, and they were like, these Jews are not who we want people to think of as Jews. So they were like, these Jews are creating anti-Semitism by being, you know, dirty and leftist. So we got to get in there and like correct these people. So when they started by saying they were fighting anti-Semitism, they didn't mean fighting prejudice. They meant making Jews that they didn't like less objectionable, right? So we're starting from a bad base, right?
Right.
As we get closer, you know, as we get to the present, I mean, the sort of thread that comes out of that, we could, you know, go through all their history, is that the ADL and the like, you might call them like the state capital class that is part of that kind of institutional leadership, is really about defending the US state as kind of a conservative Western colonial state. Same reason they're interested in Israel. They were never interested in Israel because it was like a socialist liberation project. That was a story that helped, you know, some people get on board. They were interested in Israel because they were anti-Arab and interested in colonialism. And they still are. It was really not that complicated.
I think that's important to have that history. And to your point, Mayor Gelman, this kind of crystallizes what you said. All these issues start to become intertwined. I think what we're finding is that some of the people who folks would say from afar are strange bedfellows seem to have no problem coming together, even when it looks like they're going against their interests. So we've seen some black folks stand staunchly behind Donald Trump, even though he has a history of racism. They want to somehow disassociate the role that he played with the Central Park, now exonerated five, what he did in the 70s. We saw people like Nelly say, well, that was in the 70s. He's changed. Well, he just, you know, 4 years ago was calling African countries, you know, crap hole countries, and he used the expletive to describe them. He just put in Muslim ban. He's seen, you know, the tremendous amount of people out on the streets protesting racism and police brutality. We can just go back to 2020, and we've seen this man run on a platform of saying that he's going to figure out a way to give police, you know, carte blanche immunity, which is, wow, you know. So, but we've seen people stand behind him and say, and I've heard them say it, racism is everywhere. We've been used to it. We can ignore it, but we need to get behind this guy. And they're standing behind him. And then we can go down the list with all sorts of folks, poor whites, Latinos, Asians, who have been the brunt of some of his animosity, kind of ignored and say, well, I'm on the Trump gravy train. So the deeper thing here, I guess, is what policies are you paying attention to that may be obscured because we have black and brown and women and other faces kind of becoming a distraction? So Elon Musk is a distraction unless we have a conversation about the history of the ADL, as far as I'm concerned. That's the more important thing, like, oh, okay, that's why they're there. Mm-hmm. But while we're talking about Elon Musk, what are you looking at in terms of policy that we better be keeping our eye and ear out for?
It's interesting, actually, that you're pointing to like all of the policies that Trump has sort of promised to unleash on us. That, because on the one hand, they're shocking, right? Like the idea of giving police carte blanche, or, you know, the idea of rounding up a million immigrants and deporting them. On the other hand, they're kind of just extensions of what people have been wanting to do, you know, on the right for a long time. It's not like, you know, they call it the Overton window, right? Like the sort of window of what seems possible in the present. And we kind of have labored under the delusion that the United States is a democracy and that, you know, their law and order applies. But what we have learned, you know, partly through Trump, actually, is that when somebody says something like egregious and no one responds, then that thing becomes normal, right? So I actually am thinking, you're a New Yorker, right? I'm a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. I remember the 80s. and I remember the sort of audacity of wealth, right? Like just like guys like Trump kind of, you know, sitting above the city in their gold-plated bathrooms, you know, wishing that like everything could be gentrified and they could just sweep people out, you know, mm-hmm. of the streets that they're trying to, like, you know, build their real estate empire on. And that was really, you know, you mentioned the Central Park Five, like that was really kind of the ethos. I think I was in fourth or fifth grade when that, I remember so clearly being like, okay, I get it. Like some people are disposable and some people are in charge. And so this is just it's just sort of a realization of these much deeper roots. So give the police carte blanche, sure. I mean, they that's what people have been going for all this time. So in that vein, over the last couple of years, actually, I mean, we can put a number on it. Since 2016, in my world, I work like in the world of anti-Zionism and trying to mediate like the racism and the policing and stuff that comes out of Zionism. The accusations that anybody who opposes Zionism or challenges the state of Israel is anti-Semitic have been mounting. And kind of to a certain extent, we're like, oh yeah, that's just, they're just wrong. Like, you know, they're just making the case for Israel. Actually, they've been making the case for policing and for exerting like really intense control over US, I mean, not over Palestinians, of course, also over US political speech and society. So yesterday, or the day before, I no longer know what day it is because we're in Trump land now. Trump put out an executive order called terrorists and other national security and public safety threats. And that executive order purports to, you know, to sort of be about protecting against national security threats. It allows deportation. It calls for enhanced vetting, not only of people who are coming into the country, but also of people who are already here. And it uses the terminology, I'm just looking for it here, of hateful language, hateful ideology. Those who threaten our national security espouse hateful ideology or otherwise exploit immigration laws for malevolent purposes. Well, we've been seeing on college campuses that anybody who says that they oppose genocide is called hateful, right? Like in some campuses now, a couple of campuses in the United States, being Zionist is now considered a protected identity, like being Black, right? And if you say something about being anti-Zionist, then you suddenly become subject to anti-discrimination laws. There's been legislation proposed over the last year that would call for universities to be defunded if they didn't crack down on people. But now we have an executive order that wants to deport people who are doing that, right? So this is, I think what we're seeing, like, none of this is going to be new, but the question, like what's going to be new is how the kind of infrastructure of attack, of like withdrawing public funding, of criminalizing people is going to be used to facilitate all of this stuff. It's not just, you know, it's not just we're going to deport somebody who's been arrested and, you know, prosecuted for a crime. We're going to deport somebody who said something. That's been building up over the last couple of years anyway.
I appreciate you breaking it down like that. The boundaries that are being put around saying certain things is really a very interesting situation, because while you have these laws being, or these executive orders being put into place, two things are going to become a reality for folks. One, you may be able to win in a court battle, but it might cost you $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. It might take 2 or 3 years of your life, right? So I can sit here and go, you know, Amaya Gelman, she sat here and said she's anti-Zionist. Let's bring her to court. In fact, let's see if we can deport her. Right? Oh, she's an American citizen, but she has a friend that isn't, so let's deport the friend, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you might say this is outrageous, but now we're going to go fight it in court, and you can calculate that's going to be at least $30,000, $40,000 that she's going to have to come up with. You know, it's going to take 2 or 3 years, et cetera, et cetera. And by the time everything's said and done, you may, in fact, you know, be cleared of everything, but you know, a good portion of your, there was a pound of flesh that was extracted. And I think that becomes a strategy that we've seen before in the past. Just keep bogging people down in court cases, keep bogging people down in legalese, keep bogging people down in situations when you're on college campuses. You might not go to court, but you have boards and everything else that is set up. And that's where I think it becomes scary. And I think this is also where folks have not been paying attention. And to your last point about policing, police were trying to get this sort of thing put in place for themselves. There's an array of attempts of police to, one, be seen as a protective class, two, to say anything against the police could be deemed a threat, a terrorist threat, all these different things. It didn't necessarily fly because they were doing so many egregious things, George Floyd and others, where people say, oh, hell no, we're not going to go down that road. But if you can backdoor it through Zionism or being anti-Zionist, the road is paved, precedent is set, and we have a whole bunch of fights that we didn't anticipate having all of a sudden on our hand. I did not realize that that was the depth of that executive order.
Yeah. 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 And it's, I mean, it's not, it's coded, right? It doesn't say we're targeting anti-Zionists. It says we're targeting hateful people, right? But the linkage between the idea of, you know, political speech about a genocide and hate has been made elsewhere. Actually, you know, I mean, I don't want to overly focus on universities, but like the right has been trying to push this stuff through federal legislation for years, and they haven't been able to do it. Not saying there's no bad legislation. There's plenty of terrible legislation about this stuff at the state level, but they haven't been able to get it in federal legislation. So where do they go? They go to institutions, right? It's much easier to get a rule passed at a university where one or two people make the rules than it is to get a piece of legislation passed in Congress. So, okay, Congress wouldn't pass this equation of anti-Zionism and hate. Okay, fine. So we're just gonna, like, Harvard just got sued for anti-Semitism, supposedly. And they just yesterday announced, or this morning maybe, announced that they're adopting that as a definition for their own policies, and they're partnering with a university in Israel. Like, it's, they, you know, there are other ways around it. But I want to say one other thing. This, the idea of lawfare, right? That's like also an old, you know, a sort of old tactic that's been escalating. Catch people up in lawsuits, doesn't matter. You know, if they get dismissed 5 years down the road, who cares? Because you tied them up, you know, and the right has kind of bottomless resources to do that. So like, I don't have bottomless resources, but somebody could sue me for a long time. But then, you know, the other question that comes up in a Trump era administration is, it's not just law, it's not just legal cases that can be brought against us and that we end up fighting. Like, if you can get the police to do something, right, then like, we might, you know, we might be able to sue them and say you did something wrong, but that has already been done. And that could be deportation, that can be arrests, that can be raids. Like, I think we need to be thinking bigger than, you know, of bigger impacts than lawfare, because the capacity, I mean, you know, the whole basis of the state is policing, right? If you can have laws, but they don't mean anything unless you can have somebody enforce them ultimately. We could have a conversation about, you know, whether the state is actually just inherently terrible because of that or not. But what it means is that that whoever, if, you know, whoever can move the police into place to do their bidding, kind of, you know, like, if things that we didn't expect would be possible, that we didn't expect the police would be willing to do, or the army, God forbid, right, now seem much more possible, and our capacity to resist them is fairly limited, right? Like, what do we get? I mean, I don't own a firearm.
Right.
No, I don't want to announce that up to the world. Like, no, I'm armed to the, you know, who's armed to the teeth? Police forces.
Right. You know, as you were talking, a couple of things come to mind. One, what do you see as the end game here? You got billionaires. You got more money than you could spend in 50 lifetimes. You got all the resources at your disposal. You got immense amount of power. What more do you want? What did poor, you know, Amir Gelman do to you? What did Davey D do to you? Why are we on your radar, if we are at all? You know, why are people who may be protesting a war, what did they do to you really at this stage in the game? I'm trying to understand, what do you see as being the end game to all this?
I think what did we do to them, and what is the end game, are two very different questions. What did we do to them? I mean, you know, none of this stuff works without our cooperation, right? That's why labor organizing is so powerful, and that's why people care about the student movement. You know, like, who cares if a bunch of students think that, you know, the genocide is bad? Like, actually, it does move things, and it disrupts consent. So I think that what we've done to them, you know, what they're worried about is destabilizing the consensus that makes everybody go to work, that makes everybody, you know, like, want to buy a television. I think that when I have teenagers and I watch them shop, you know, like I watch them online shop and they, you know, they can't buy so much stuff, but they want everything. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that is, that's what's making their, those billionaires, billionaires. Now, why do they need to be billionaires? Why do they need to keep acquiring more and more and more? That I think is a psychological question. I don't really have an answer for it. But I think we're disrupting that. I think that's what we're doing to them. And then I think also there's like a little bit of fetishization of control. Like even if we don't have any impact, like their whole brand is the iron fist, right? Like they're the kings and we're not. What's the end game? Oh, no, let's hear. I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think what you were saying, the iron fist and control, it used to be, as the last poets would say, you know, having a God complex. There's nothing else for you to do except be God at this point. You know, you could do anything you want. So now let me see how I can play God, almost in a Hunger Game type of scenario. Remember the scene in Hunger Gang where you have the gods, like individuals sitting there going, ah, Emma's running through the forest. Let's take a lion and see how she reacts. Let's put a storm there. And I think you literally have folks who want to do that and get off on seeing what sort of reaction they can accrue from the masses. That's, you know, that becomes a fun thing, almost the ultimate way to troll people at the end of the day, because you certainly can't be doing this for more money. You know, whatever money I have or you have is pennies to your billions, right? So it can't be that. And we're not really threats to you in the traditional sense. I can't take your money, your property, or anything like that. I may have a different ideology, which, you know, I'm trying to get to people, but you control all the means of communication at this point. You know, you have all the TV and radio and bottomless resources, so you can get your message across much more powerfully than I can. So it has to be, at this point, I get off on seeing you squirm. I get off on seeing the look of agony in your face is the way that I see that. The God complex. People should listen to that last poet record and remember what they said. Maybe we'll play it.
Sun up down on the corner uptown. I turn around and hear the sound of voices talking about who's gonna die next. Cause the white man's got a God complex. I'm making guns.
I'm God.
I'm God. I'm making bombs.
I'm God.
I'm God. I'm making gas.
I'm God.
I'm making freak machines.
I'm God.
Birth control pills.
I'm God.
Kill Indians who discovered him.
I'm God.
Kill Japanese with the A-bomb.
I'm God.
Kill and still killing black people.
I'm God.
Enslaving Earth.
I'm God.
No one to the moon.
I'm God.
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 I do want to ask you this, though. The type of direction we're headed is not limited to what's here. And so I wanted to ask you initially when you came on the show is ceasefire. You know, what does that really mean? I know you wrote something eloquently about it, about how we should be careful about even using that word, or at least have some context to it. But what does this mean at this hour? Some people are cheering. Hey, the hostages are home. They're going to stop. And maybe everything that we witnessed for the past year and a half is over. Or is it? What are you concerned about when you hear there's a ceasefire deal in place?
Right. Well, first of all, there, of course, like the sense of relief that there will be even less bombing, right? Like, I'm taking it. What we know about ceasefires, and like particularly in the Israeli context, is that the Israeli government kills as many people as it can before implementing a ceasefire, which it did. It just went on a rampage in the hours before the ceasefire was supposed to take effect. It continued to kill people after the ceasefire. Today, there was an invasion of the West Bank. It's not over, right? And not only is the immediate assault on Palestinian life and space and you know, systems and history and everything not over. But colonialism is not over. And we know, among other things that we know the house always wins, right? So in the case of Israeli colonialism, just because the Israeli state agrees to a ceasefire in a particular assault does not mean that it stopped its expansionism. So there are lots of different ways that the Israeli state expands into Palestine and actually beyond Palestine. It uses settlers to attack Palestinians and, you know, and like seize houses and destroy trees and take land. It uses control of the borders to make sure people can't bring materials in to rebuild. It, you know, it controls people's movement. So sure, ceasefire. I like, listen, I'm not going to dump on ceasefire because many fewer people are dying right now than a week ago, right? But it doesn't mean peace. It doesn't mean decolonization. And just in the same way that you were talking about, like, what is it that people, you know, what are they getting out of like squeezing us so hard? Like, there is something psychological, something sadistic in the mm-hmm. Israeli state that persists. It's also hard because, you know, we know in this country that as soon as something is less acute, that people kind of turn away from it.
Right.
So I'm also worried about that. And I mean, you know, people did that during the Biden administration. Yes, Trump is terrible, right? Trump is like coming for all of us. Trump is going to give police, you know, free rein to prosecute people for hateful ideology. Biden administration did that too. The Biden administration declared as a terror threat to the United States people who are anti-capitalist, right? Like, this is, you know, it goes on and on. So it certainly becomes more acute and more dangerous at different times, and it certainly focuses its danger on different sets of people, right? Like, you know, immigrants in the city are in deep, deep shit right now. And, you know, everybody is trying to train up to understand, like, what does an ICE van look like? What do you do? I'm not saying there's no shift.
Right.
This is a long game, a very long game.
What would you suggest people do to protect themselves? You know, historically, if you look at it, what did people do moving forward with a state apparatus that I think has studied history while simultaneously telling us history doesn't count and banning books? You know, they're reading all those books, those manifestos, looking at those old tapes and understanding and saying, we will not make this mistake again, so we'll adopt and we'll adjust. So in the new world, what do you think we should be doing?
Well, that's a good question. One thing we've learned is that this machinery advances by testing us, and when we don't respond, it's like, okay, well, that worked, right? So it's very hard not to be kind of numbed to all the crazy, crazy stuff that's happening, but we have to continue to object, right? We have to continue to say, like, that was a Nazi salute, guys. You know, like, we're not taking that one. And to not allow it to become normal. So often that means taking risks, and people have to decide what kind of risks are they going to take. Like, the risks are different for different sets of people. Some people have always been at risk, and maybe, like, you know, maybe now they don't want to be at extra risk.
Right.
I don't know. I think we really have to have a conversation with ourselves, each of ourselves, to figure out, like, what kind of risks we're going to try and take right now. Not only in defense of ourselves, but in defense of, like, our kids' future, or I don't know. I mean, so I think we're going to have to take some risks. And then I think in a totally other context, I have been trying to understand, like, what is it? Where is the line between passive resistance, where people, you know, look at something like, oh, I got to go on a protest march and I have to object to that, and deciding that those methods are no longer really available to us. Like, politics doesn't work anymore, right? Like, our objections don't count. Like, at what point do people start to organize? I haven't studied this, but I'm curious. What point do people start to organize, like, you know, logistical resistance cells? I don't know.
Well, this comes back to what we were saying, is that they studied the past. Mm-hmm. I often tell people, study the case in Albany, Georgia during the Civil Rights Movement, where Dr. King, by his own admission, said he lost. And that was to Sheriff Laurie Pritchard, who bragged on Eyes on the Prize. He said, I read King's books. Most of my contemporaries didn't. I studied his method. So when King came down to Albany talking about he's going to fill the jails, he laughs. He goes, I made sure that there was enough jails to accommodate every last one of them. I rented out jails all around. And so when King brought his tactic to bear, and it's like, we'll just go fill up the jails, Laurie's like, man, we got jail down the street, up around the block. I got my boy down in another county. So he's able to do that. And King talked about, you know, that, like, he got outsmarted. And Pritchard is on there laughing. He's like, yeah, I studied the enemy. So I bring this up to say that while I feel we're being distracted by the Elon Musk and their Nazi salutes, these folks are not dumb. And we should not think that. And I'm thinking, like, wow, there was a war on drugs that a bumbling Richard Nixon launched, which destabilized the Black Power movement and the anti-war movement. And then it was picked up by Ronald Reagan, who was a distraction because he was talking funny and he looked like, you know, hey there, people would make fun of the way he talked, but he continued that war on drugs. And by the time he left office, you know, our prison population had quadrupled. You know, he did a Laurie Pritchard. He got, I got enough jail cells for everybody. Because people in the 80s were like, you can't arrest everybody. They literally did. Right. And so now what's the next iteration of that as we get, as we look at, you know, Snoop Dogg and Nelly dancing at crypto parties with Trump and the whole nine? Those are distractions, but man, they're putting policies in place. And we mentioned Steve Bannon, we mentioned Elon Musk, but Stephen Miller is sitting up there in, you know, chief of staff or at least close to it in the White House.
Yeah.
You know, these are policies that they're unearthing that I'm concerned about. And if there is this different type of dance with Israel where an anti-Semitic can get cover from the Anti-Defamation League, then that's a whole new twist in the armor that I think we need to be looking at. It makes me wonder, like, what sort of role will Israel play globally and even here in the States, you know, as we rise to fascism? You know, what is the dance that Israel's going to rise under the banner of Zionism, which, you know, they're trying to make it, as you pointed out, an outlaw just to even say, outlaw just us even saying that word.
There are so many moving parts here. I was thinking as you were talking, like, this is actually, some of this is not actually unprecedented, right? Like, if you think back to, like, the Pinkerton guards, mm-hmm. you know, like, this level of repression and also the sense that the state or the bosses like really own us, you know, that's not new. It's not recent, but it has happened in the past. And the two things come to mind about that. One is that a lot of people were killed, right, in the process of resisting that. And I fear that we're going down that road. But the other is that at some point, like, you know, as we were saying before, like, those bosses and the kind of like lords of the state cannot function without our labor. Mm-hmm. So, and I've been, you know, very disappointed in the labor movement lots of times. Like, it's not, I'm not looking at it as a sort of savior space, but I do think that we have to figure out like where we have power and how we can leverage it. On the other hand, we are in a very different situation because of the level of surveillance and the level at which like our daily operations, our whole lives are kind of run, mediated through technology that's owned by corporations and like right-wing nutcases, basically, like Elon Musk. So it may be that we also have to figure out how to get offline. Like, we may have to, you know, like reorient ourselves geographically. As far as Israel is concerned, that's part of the same kind of infrastructure of like incredible militarism, you know, like the fact that the cops are armed with tanks, right? They're not just armed with the guns that will kill us. They're armed with the tanks that will knock our houses down, right? And so is Israel. But it's helpful to remember that the state of Israel is, you know, not even 80 years old, right? It didn't exist at one point. People are abandoning it like a, you know, rats on a sinking ship. The United States is not that old. Like, these conditions that we think of as like kind of, you know, in stone are not actually in stone. Things could dramatically shift. The one thing that when I'm feeling desperate like this, which I do feel desperate, right? I totally feel desperate. The thing that I hang on to, that I know from being an organizer and the history of organizing, is that often the way things shift is like something completely unexpected happens, right? Like, we're organizing, we've built our community, we've built our structures, we know what we value, and we're not getting anywhere. And then something happens that we didn't do, but we're able to step into it because we've been organizing. And I can't really see what the end game is, but
they say if you're prepared, if you stay ready, you don't have, you know, when you can take advantage of the opportunities. So we got to stay ready. And as you're talking, Amaya, I'm thinking to myself, well, part of being ready is communication. Mm-hmm. Being intentional about crossing lines above and outside your community in a very intentional way. Like, maybe me and you have to go to lunch, you know, and our crews have to go to lunch, you know, not because we like each other or anything. So we get to know each other. So if there's an issue, oh, let me call a homegirl down the street. I know her personally. Hey, do you know about this? And, you know, and then we all have a commitment to each other to bring our A game to the table. So ain't nobody taking shortcuts. That's a very deliberate strategy. It's something that people have gotten away from doing, but it's something that we have to do, you know? So we have to kind of reorient ourselves. I think you said getting offline and really get to know each other in a very different way, you know, outside of the middleman of social media, which is documenting and surveilling and capitalizing on all that. Go back to the days where folks are afraid, like, why are they sitting in the park? What are they doing? You know, why is that woman with the green glasses hanging out with the guy with the black hoodie? What are they talking about? You know, we might be talking about the football game, or we might be plotting and planning. But the fact is that we're going to have to know each other better and very intentionally, whether it's local neighbors and what have you. And I think that is going to take that's going to have to be a front and center type of thing that we do, because it seems like that's what they're doing on the other side.
Yeah, they're getting to, they're like training and they're in the same place. They're out in the field. Yeah.
Sure. They're out there doing it. I appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. Mia, first of all, let people know how they can follow your work, support your work. Any marching orders? I know I had to ask you, but if you have any other marching orders you want to give our audience, please do. Anything that we missed that it's like, you know what, pay attention to this. We appreciate your wisdom and insight, so we're all ears.
I really appreciate the conversation. People can find the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism at criticalzionismstudies.org, and our website has like everything from, you know, academic research to zines that are explainers. So hopefully there's something
What's that site again? One more time.
criticalzionismstudies.org. But there's also another site that if people are thinking about the ADL, which, you know, you should be, that has a lot of stuff on it, and that's drop.theadl.org. But I will also just add that there are, because it's so powerful to do that kind of like using the claim of like fighting anti-Semitism to get done all kinds of nefarious stuff that the right has been trying to get done, that the ADL is not even the only place to look anymore, right? So I just want to also just be mindful, like, there are a lot of little copycat organizations doing exactly the same thing, and the threat is like way more diffuse than it used to be. So so yeah, we need to get together and just know each other and be ready.
Well, AIPAC would be one of them.
AIPAC's a big one, but there's also lots of little tiny ones. So like, you know, Mothers Against College Anti-Semitism started out as a Facebook group, and now it's a, you know, it's like a 501c3 that's calling, it's calling on its 50, 60,000 members to like drop a dime basically on protesters the anti-genocide protesters to try and get them deported using this new executive order. I mean, like, it's diffused. There's eyes on the street. I have a friend who studies journalism on the right. He calls it the Palestine scare, just like the Red Scare. And it is, like, you know, they see it like a communist in every closet, an anti-Semite in every closet.
Real talk. So we will definitely keep our eyes and ears peeled. And I like the fact that you reminded us of the Red Scare, you know, and drawing the parallel to the Palestine scare, you know. And I think they've been very intentional by saying if you support Palestine, you are pro-Hamas, and, you know, and then knowing that Hamas in the minds of many will equate to terror. And then they use words like terrorist group. And then once you toss that word out, it opens up a whole other playbook that can be applied. And so those are things that we got to kind of be aware of and understand that that is what they're trying to do. We appreciate you taking time out. We will definitely stay in touch. We are going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
In the shadows of history, a truth takes form, a shield against hate in a time of storm. What began as a quest for a place to belong grew into a tale where rights went wrong. A vision of safety paved the fractured way, leaving displacement where dreams should stay. Zionism shifted, the vision redefined. A settler state born where justice is confined. Apartheid reigns where freedom should thrive. A broken promise struggling to survive. We must free Palestine. Why did Zionism become a beacon for hate? Why did it resurrect an apartheid state? Why did Zionism become a force to divide? With settlement spreading and truth denied, we must free Palestine. Zionism shifted, the vision redefined. A settler state born where justice is confined. Apartheid reigns where freedom should thrive. A broken promise struggling to survive. We must free Palestine. Palestine, free.
Hard Knock.
Palestine.
Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Palestine.
We saw the gesture broadcast worldwide. A billionaire's hand raised with a cry. A symbol of hate, a chilling sign. A moment that shook the fragile line. Fear in our hearts, outrage in the air. How could power and cruelty pair? And yet they denied with a sly, cold grin, betraying the truth, excusing the sin. So raise your hand and raise our voice. In the face of hate, we still have a choice. Neo-Nazi in the White House, what are we to do? If they're coming for me, they'll soon come for you. No time for silence, we gotta kick down the door. Stand our ground and unite and raise the 4-4. Gesture of hate by a tech billionaire. It was a Nazi salute designed to spark fear. The past screams loud, we won't forget. We gonna stand strong and make them regret. There's no turning back. Gotta fight hard and defeat any attack. Sister Big Jane is gonna stand her ground. No more Nazi salutes.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
This is Bird Note. For small songbirds, surviving a cold winter night can be challenging. Their bodies lose heat faster than those of larger birds, so little birds have found resourceful ways to stay warm, like huddling close together with others. Some snuggle into old bird nests, others shelter in a dense mass of leaves. But the verdon, a tiny bird of the Southwest, does something few other birds do to keep warm. It builds special nests to roost in the winter. Desert nights are often cold, so warm roosts are crucial. The birds build roosting nests all year long, as well as breeding nests in the spring. But the nests they build for the winter are smaller and warmly lined with feathers and dry grass. Verdons are prolific nest builders, so they may have several nests at the ready. This generous supply of snug bungalows can help other birds, too. In Arizona, one verdon nest hosted 15 black-tailed gnatcatchers, all crammed in for 5 cold nights in a row. For a verdon, having gnatcatchers crash in one of its nests isn't a big problem. It can just snuggle into one of its spares. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Something went wrong. You told me to change.
just what to do. And everybody says I'm just a fool over you.
KBOO Portland.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country.